Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello everyone and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Today we are finding out about the battleship HMS Bearham. This is part of our iconic ship series. It's actually episode 12, so if you've not managed to listen to any others, do please find the rest of them online, wherever you get your podcasts or at snr.org.uk. There is a veritable fleet of iconic ships we have covered, both merchant and naval and leisure ships as well, covering centuries of history. Today we are looking at HMS Bearham because it is the 25th of November, and on this day in history in the Second World War, HMS Bearham was sunk by a U-boat, and the event astonishingly was captured on film. To tell me more about the remarkable ship and the dreadful events of this day in 1941, I'm speaking to Dr. Phil Weir. Phil is a naval historian, and he is, without doubt, the most active naval historian on Twitter. You can find him with the well-selected Twitter handle at Naval Historian. Phil has recently published a book about Dunkirk called Dunkirk and the Little Ships, which I would urge you all to buy for Christmas. Here is Phil. Phil, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Pleasure as always, Sam.
HMS Bearham, I mean, we decided to have this discussion because I think primarily of the unbelievable images that survive of the explosion. I came across it a few years ago, and I was astonished at the kind of the graphic detail of it. It really brought home the, you know, the violence of warfare at sea in the Second World War. But I was also amazed by how few people had seen it. It almost feels like it's something that should be better known than it is. Have you seen the pictures?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's one of, I think, really only two battleships that ever caught on moving pictures. The other one was the Austro-Hungarian battleship that was also frequently used, and again, torpedoed by an Italian torpedo boat, and is caught on camera, capsizing in a very similar fashion. So yeah, I mean, it's quite phenomenal as footage, and you know, almost unique.
It's extraordinary when you look at it in detail as well. I should say to everyone who's listening, you haven't seen the footage of HMS Bearham exploding, shocking and sad as it is, do check us out, the Society for Nautical Research's Twitter feed or Facebook, or on the Mariner's Mirror Pod Instagram. We'll be able to get it up there for you all to look. But you know, obviously you've got this extraordinary scale of the explosion, but when if you look closer, you can actually see people scrabbling around on the hull as it capsizes.
Absolutely, yeah. It's absolutely incredible footage. And she goes down in very, very short space of time. So casualties are obviously very high. The torpedoes, you know, start filling her with water. She starts capsizing. The abandoned ship order is given, although it's, you know, fairly obvious that at this point, you need to get out.
On fire.
And yeah, the magazines get touched off, and there's this almighty explosion. And as you say, you can still see there are people, you know, desperately scrambling over the hull of this rapidly capsizing battleship to try to get off. And it's incredible visceral imagery of these poor guys who, you know, are literally in a lot of cases at that point here one second and gone the next.
Yeah. Well, let's rewind a bit and we'll find out about HMS Bearham. So tell me about the ship.
Well, HMS Bearham was one of the, probably the most successful, remarkable class of battleship perhaps ever built. She was also extremely consequential in many ways. Now, she was fourth ship in the Queen Elizabeth class, very famous class of battleship, they are the most powerful battleships, arguably, of the First World War. They are the fastest, biggest guns, huge 32,000-ton beasts. They're the first ships armed with the 15-inch guns, the huge things that you see outside the Imperial War Museum.
I know them exactly, yeah.
Those are the exact guns. They were, in fact, effectively created for the Queen Elizabeth class.
Right.
They're the first ones to be fitted with these things. So they've got enormous gun power, very well armoured, very fast. And the speed is an interesting one. And this is one of the sort of key consequential bits of these ships. Because they're the Royal Navy's first solely oil-fired battleships, which of course comes with geopolitical consequences.
Yeah.
Britain doesn't have, at this point, a domestic supply of oil. So back in 1886, I think Britain's first big oil company, the Burma Oil Company, is founded in to exploit the oil fields of Burma. A little bit further down the line, it's sort of becoming obvious that oil fuel is perhaps the way to go, because obviously Britain's got huge amounts of coal and has been since HMS Warrior, and obviously before HMS Warrior, Britain's been using coal to fire its steam engines on board its warships and other ships. But of course, oil, you get a lot more power per ton out of it. It's a lot cleaner to refuel, a lot easier. You can actually use pumps to put it into boilers rather than lots of large sweaty men with shovels and so forth. The Admiralty starts looking at oil in around 1904-ish, and they convert a little torpedo boat destroyer, HMS Spiteful, to oil firing, and they put her up against one of her sister ships. I think it's HMS Petrel, it's blindingly obvious that Spiteful is quicker, far faster to fuel and all the rest of it. It's a remarkable change. So they start moving towards oil firing, start building another class of destroyers. I think the Tribal class are the first ones that are solely oil fired. But still, they haven't quite made the move with the big battleships, which obviously use thousands and thousands of tons of their stuff. And obviously that's because of the supply issues.
Yeah.
And it's not really until an offshoot of the Burma Oil Company, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, starts digging around the Middle East, and you can see where the geopolitical consequences start coming in, that the Admiralty really starts looking at this. And in 1912, around the same time, they're deciding to build the Queen Elizabeths and go to the 15-inch guns and so forth. They also decide to go for oil, and thereafter buy a very large chunk out of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, put one of their admirals, Vice Admiral Sir Edmund Slade, on the board, and thereafter Britain has a serious interest in the Middle East, because that's where the oil comes from to fire the Royal Navy's battleships.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
So they, in effect, they come with a very, you know, serious geopolitical consequences. Not to say, of course, that Britain wouldn't have been involved in the oil trade and in the Middle East anyway, because, of course, oil is so utterly ubiquitous to our lives. But you know, the Royal Navy and the Queen Elizabeth class, and obviously as part of that HMS Barham, is, you know, right at the core of this.
And what was her role in the First World War? How did they use this amazing new weapon?
Well, the Queen Elizabeth class, they all have fairly active First World War. Queen Elizabeth herself gets sent to Gallipoli as her shakedown kind of thing. But the main thing they do is they are at the core of the Grand Fleet, the most powerful squadron there. All of them, bar Queen Elizabeth, which I think is under refit at the time, and led by HMS Barham, as the 5th Battle Squadron take part in the Great Battle of Jutland, very active part in the battle there. They're with Beatty's Battle Cruiser Force, and they, he handles them fairly badly, so, you know, takes them, positions them too far away to begin with to properly support him. And then when he runs into the German battle fleet, he effectively sort of leaves them almost fighting off the entire German fleet
on their own.
They take a fair bit of damage in the process, but they perform superbly. I mean, they cause a hell of a lot of damage in return because, of course, of their huge guns. I mean, it's just literally, say, the most powerful battleships in the world. And, you know, they are there for the surrender of the High Seas Fleet at the end of the war. Queen Elizabeth is of course as the flagship of the entire fleet, is the site of the little surrender ceremony of the High Seas Fleet, something that was of course somewhat replicated 25 odd years later for the surrender of Japan. So that's, you know, all highly consequential, and obviously, interesting little aside, they're also the duty battle squadron at the time the High Seas Fleet scuttles itself in 1919. They are the first ones on the scene. Then have a sort of fairly busy interwar period, doing the usuals of the Spanish Civil War and bits of imperial policing in Palestine and all the rest of it.
Flag waving, threatening.
Flying the flag and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, that's kind of their role. They've already had very active lives, and a number of them start to be almost effectively entirely rebuilt, and especially famously Warspite, Queen Elizabeth and Valiant get almost entirely rebuilt with new anti-aircraft guns, armour, engines and so forth. Barham is not as heavily rebuilt. I mean, she does get some modernisation before the Second World War, but not a great deal.
Mm-hmm. But then the Second World War comes, and they've got this extraordinary weapon, and they need to use her as effectively as possible. And she finds herself in the Mediterranean.
Yes,
primarily. That's that becomes the focus of her work.
She does indeed. And indeed, at the start of the war, despite the fact that the war is kind of going on elsewhere, she's actually sort of left in the Mediterranean for the first 6-9 months of the war, out until the end of December 1939. She pretty much is the Mediterranean fleet for a large chunk of this, because obviously the rest of the Mediterranean fleet's been drawn back home. And she then heads home, and it's not the greatest of homecomings, because she finds herself, basically runs into one of her escorting destroyers, HMS Duchess, and sinks it literally as she's approaching Scotland on the journey home, which wasn't great.
Does that happen at night or in a fog or something?
It's bad weather, but yeah, it's really quite tragic accident.
Well, a very sad way to begin the war.
Absolutely. Not long thereafter, Berham herself is torpedoed by, I think it's the U-30, and takes some damage and is out for the next 6 months, so misses Norway and various other bits and pieces around there. And when she rejoins the home fleet, she's fairly promptly thereafter actually sent down, and bear in mind this is sort of August, September time in 1940, so height of the Battle of Britain. Churchill decides to send a small fleet down to what is now Senegal, Dakar, with Charles de Gaulle aboard.
Mm. Why is he doing that? What's that for?
It's basically an attempt, because France has obviously just surrendered. De Gaulle has basically become the leader of a French government in exile, in effect. And what they want to do is try to bring over some of the French Empire to the Free French. So they send down de Gaulle and fleet led by Berham with Vice Admiral John Cunningham aboard to try to persuade the French authorities in French West Africa, as they now Senegal, to change sides. It does not go terribly well, and Berham and I think it's Resolution, she's with the other battleship, end up exchanging fire with the French battleship Richelieu. Mm. A French submarine then torpedoes Resolution, and Berham has to sort of tow her away to Freetown in Sierra Leone, and that's kind of the end of the operation. Mm-hmm. It's something of an unfortunate fiasco at that point. And Berham is then sent back home, and interestingly, going via Gibraltar, she comes very close to being victim of one of the first attacks by Italian naval commandos using sort of little human torpedoes.
At this stage, is the French Navy still a significant strategic problem?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the French Navy it remains a significant problem. It's a lot of it has been neutralised with a major operation against the French fleet at Merzel Kebir, and also the elements of the French fleet that were at Alexandria, and also that had gone to Britain at when France had been invaded. So there was this whole huge operation in July, just before Berham gets sent down to Dakar, that they, the Royal Navy, effectively takes out sort of half the French fleet. Mm. In literally a couple of days. They're all either captured or, of course, tragically at Merzel Kebir, a significant number of them are sunk. So there is still a problem. There are still survivors out there. Richelieu is brand new, just about complete, and she's actually one of the most powerful battleships in the world at this point. Mm. So she's highly dangerous, highly difficult problem for the Royal Navy if she actually comes out and does anything. But fortunately, that doesn't really occur.
So on the one hand, we've got the French, and then the other hand, you mentioned the Italians, and they're starting this human torpedo thing. So there's an Italian threat in the Mediterranean as well.
Absolutely, yes. The Italians have declared war in June, just before the French surrender. So that suddenly completely opens up another front. The British have had to start recreating the Mediterranean fleet almost from scratch, drawing forces down away from Britain that might otherwise have been put to use in the defence of Britain against potential invasion and so forth. So huge strategic shift going on there. The Suez Canal route is effectively kind of shut, so British merchant shipping now has to go right round Africa, and it's a massive strategic shift.
And all to do with oil as well, which is where we started off talking about, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. It's the route through which Britain's oil comes, now has to, can't come through the Mediterranean. It's got to go around Africa, so you need more shipping, and there's a higher level of threat up the Atlantic route, and it's, it's a massive, as I say, massive strategic shift that happens in and around that sort of mid 1940 point.
Yeah. So Behrum has this fiasco with de Gaulle, and that doesn't really work. And then, did you say she was torpedoed or was nearly torpedoed?
It's on her way back. So she comes up from Freetown having towed resolution in. And heads back up to Gibraltar and is sat there refueling for a couple of days. And the Italians decide to go for a little commando raid, basically. They send a couple of manned torpedoes from the what will become the famous Decima Mas, the 10th Commando Unit of the Italian Navy. They become very famous for this sort of stuff, and they send these little manned torpedoes into Gibraltar to try to attach a massive charge to Behrum's hull, and sink her at harbour in Gibraltar. Now they don't quite make it. They get to within about 200 feet of her hull and end up having to sort of let the charge off there and hope that the shock wave will do something. It doesn't, but it's kind of a warning shot that these guys are out there and are starting to do things, which isn't entirely heeded, as future events end up proving. But she thereafter heads up entirely safely and gets back to Britain. And then is involved in one of the big, really great operations of the war, and this is her return to the Mediterranean, and it's all part of the operation that ends up with the sinking of half the Italian fleet by the aircraft at Carrier Illustrious at Taranto.
Yep.
Now, Behrum's part in this is, basically, she's loaded up with a battalion of troops, and she's to go right through the middle of the Mediterranean.
Yeah. Well, one of the advantages, just to jump in there, is of these battleships, they are so enormous. They're also very, very effective for carrying troops, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, you can quite happily do stuff like this. And, of course, they're quick, well-armoured and so forth, and you can actually send troops on them with a reasonable chance that they're going to make it, rather than on a slow, badly protected troop ship, potentially.
Yeah. I wonder if that was they were aware of that, the designers, when they originally built them, or for the First World War they were just imagining huge battle fleets fighting each other in the North Sea.
I think it was primarily for naval warfare rather than amphibious warfare. But I mean, the Royal Navy had long sort of done bits and pieces like this. I mean, notably, I think the defence of Antwerp in 1914, with the Royal Naval Division, was delivered by the old pre-dreadnought battleships in the Channel Squadron. So they do stuff like this, I think some of the older battleships were also involved in carting troops around at Gallipoli as well. Yeah, so this sort of thing does happen, but for the most part, the design is principally around naval warfare.
Yeah, about around those guns. Anyway, so she's in the Med and she's got a battalion of troops on.
Yeah, so she obviously heads back down from Britain via Gibraltar, and it's the thing we always remember about Taranto is the great airstrike by the Swordfish off of Illustrious on Taranto. But there's this huge operation around it that it involves convoys to Greece, convoys to Malta from Alexandria, convoys to Malta from Gibraltar, a couple of airstrikes from Ark Royal heading from Gibraltar onto Sardinia. It's an enormous operation. Behrum's part on all of this is to cart this battalion of troops through to Malta and then proceed on to Alexandria to reinforce the Mediterranean fleet as another battleship. And she does this, pretty spectacularly. They sort of head through the Mediterranean, and Ark Royal launches her airstrikes, and Behram arrives with, I think it's a couple of cruisers, and they've got troops aboard as well, arrive in Malta, because of course Malta, just to explain, of course, is so close to Italy that it's had to be abandoned as the traditional great fleet base of the Royal Navy in the Mediterranean. They've had to pull back to Alexandria because of the threat of air attack. But you still do get visits by ships just sort of temporarily, and Behram and this little fleet sort of arrive, and they get the troops out on deck, do the full lining of the deck, bands playing, the whole nine yards, and make a sort of terrific spectacle out of this, and deliver these guys off and then pop off out. And it's quite spectacular for morale, of course. You get to see this huge ship with the full band playing and all this sort of stuff. That's Behram's part in all of this, and she's obviously a notable part of that operation. And then finds herself in Alexandria for what will now be the final year of her life.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So Alexandria being temporarily used as a naval base by the British.
Yes, it was designated as their backup fleet base when Italy starts to become more of a threat around the Abyssinia crisis in 1935, and the British suddenly start realizing that, okay, if we find ourselves at war with Italy, Malta's probably not going to be tenable as a fleet base. Yeah. You're just going to end up with your fleet badly damaged by air attack and so forth. And we need a backup base, and particularly something in the eastern basin that helps protect the vital Suez Canal. And Alexandria basically fits the bill.
Yeah. So she's there. I mean, it must lead towards the Battle of Matapan with dealing with the Italians finally. Was she involved in that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, she ends up. It's becomes a fairly busy routine of basically supporting the army and its operations in North Africa. So there's bombardments, famously of Bardia, Tripoli, and Benghazi as well, I think. And this is just sort of in support of the army's efforts in North Africa, first against the Italians and against Rommel and the Germans, but also defending convoys and covering convoys that are heading for Malta or indeed for Greece, which has just been invaded by Italy just before Behram arrives. So Matapan is, of course, one of the big convoys out to Greece. Now, it's one of those fascinating little ones, because Britain has just, and it's incredible piece of luck and skill, it must be said, Bletchley Park and a little team in there They discover that the Italian fleet is planning to attack a convoy that's heading for Piraeus in Greece, a troop convoy. And thereafter, this sort of big operation is put together. Admiral Cunningham, the commander-in-chief, you know, takes his golf clubs ashore and makes like he's off for a weekend of golfing, yeah. And then races back aboard.
He is an amazing character as well. If any of your listeners want to investigate a British admiral of the Second World War, look at Cunningham. He's fantastic.
Absolutely. He's one of the great characters and one of the great fighting admirals of the Royal Navy.
Yeah. Do you know who his secretary was? My grandfather.
I did not know that.
There you go.
Alec, we have known each other for God knows how many years, and you had not mentioned that to me, Sam.
No, well, there you are.
Damn you.
There we are. So he goes ashore with his golf clubs to pretend everything's kind of okay. The British aren't doing anything.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's the Alexandria at this point in time is kind of full of various agents and so forth that would reveal movements to the Italians, particularly the Japanese ambassador, a rather rotund chap who I think Cunningham nicknamed the blunt end of the axis.
Right. Very good.
Who, like I said, the Japanese and the Italians were actually pretty close, and the Italians allow the Japanese to look into the results of Taranto, of course, with... One can over-exaggerate the effects. It doesn't entirely lead to Pearl Harbor, but it kind of nudges things a bit further in that direction. The Japanese ambassador is particularly one they like to fool. And nightfall comes, and of course, you know, Cunningham hot foots it back, blacked out car back to HMS Warspite, one of Bearham's sisters, she's the fleet flagship, loads himself aboard, and they sail under the cover of darkness and head out into the Mediterranean. And obviously the Italian fleet under Admiral Iacino is heading in the opposite direction. And what follows is, in some respects, a sort of classical sea battle. You kind of get the two cruiser forces meet first, and the British cruisers try and draw the Italian cruisers back onto the guns of Cunningham's battleships. Iacino, with his flagship Vittoria Veneto, moves in to cut the cruisers off, and the cruisers kind of the British cruisers have to be kind of rescued by an airstrike from HMS Formidable that shifts the Italians off for a bit, and the chase kind of resumes, and thereafter there's another couple of strikes from Formidable. These have huge consequences for the course of the battle. One of them hits Iacino's flagship, the Vittoria Veneto, right in the stern. It's that vital soft spot that kills the Bismarck and later Prince of Wales, and slows down horribly and is basically now sort of out of the battle and is in serious danger if Cunningham catches up with her. The next one hits the heavy cruiser Polar. Mm-hmm. Now, these two ships end up suffering rather different fates because through some brilliant damage control and engineering work, Iacino's crew on the Veneto managed to get her moving again and obviously start limping for home. Polar's crew do not, and Polar is left behind with two other cruisers, the Zara and the Fiume, under Vice Admiral Cattaneo. And they're sort of there to try and escort her back, but she's basically not going anywhere. Night's falling at this point, and effectively Veneto manages to get back home. Zara, Pola and Fiume are effectively run into by Cunningham's full battle fleet, and the British at this point, unlike Bearham's previous experience at Jutland, The British fleet at this point is now very well trained in night fighting. The battleship Valiant has got radar. And they just sort of sweep in, find these cruisers. The Italians are not terribly well trained in night fighting, incidentally, of course. So the Italian cruisers are completely unprepared, and the British should have come in. And they get in really close. There's about 3,000-4,000 yards, point-blank range for those vast guns. And they open fire, and they just smash them. It's just complete turkey shoot, basically. And there's a famous painting by Roland Langmaid of the sort of scene of the battle. And Bearham, which is bringing up the rear of the line, is, of course, it's painting that's done from the rear quarters, so Bearham at the rear is of course front and centre to all of this. And you've got searchlights reaching out to the cruiser Zara, which is her target, and those 15-inch guns at minimum depression just firing into this poor Italian cruiser. Just caught completely by surprise, and obviously no way of standing up to that level of firepower. And they, each of the battleships fires 5-6 salvos each, and that's it.
That's it, all done.
Yeah. And thereafter, they can't catch the Vittoria Veneto, so that's pretty much the end of the battle, and they turn for home.
But it's dealt a huge blow to the Italian
absolutely.
Sea power, isn't it?
Huge blow. It's just, basically wipes out a cruiser squadron there. In one fell swoop. It's...
Yeah. So the combination of the airstrike on the on their naval base and then this sea battle effectively removes the Italians?
Not entirely. The Italian fleet is one of those that I think we tend to over-exaggerate a little the effects on the Italian fleet. The Italian fleet does still keep banging away and keeps doing things.
It's amazing how often that's a theme that happens in naval history, where there has been a battle and everyone assumes that that's the end of the defeated fleet's influence. And it just doesn't work like that, does it?
It does not, no. And it doesn't in this case. And the Italian fleet, I mean, it's hamstrung particularly and primarily, really, by lack of oil and difficulties in repairing damaged ships. That's really the key problem to a lot of their mobility. But they do still keep coming out, and you get the battles of Sirt going ahead later on into sort of 1942 and so forth. And it's really, it's out until the sort of invasions of North Africa and then Italy and Sicily and Italy itself. They don't really respond to those, but they are still active throughout a large chunk of the rest of 41, 42.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the next stage is Crete must be the next big campaign, is it?
Absolutely, yeah.
So what's going on there? Why is Crete important?
Well, it's all to do with, I mentioned the Italian invasion of Greece. That didn't go terribly well, and the Germans then, remarkably, They sort of repeat Norway in terms of is a wild dispersion of their efforts. They're obviously at this point prepping to do this huge invasion of the Soviet Union, yeah. But Hitler authorizes this little sideshow off down to the south, much as when they were preparing for the invasion of France, they disappeared off to Norway. These generals think it's nuts. But so by the end of April. In essence, the Allies are having to withdraw from Greece, and they start an evacuation process. And in the middle of this, the Germans go for broke. It's a completely mad operation, but they decide to go for the island of Crete, which has got a British airfield and British garrison, New Zealanders as well, on it. And they go for this despite the fact that the Mediterranean fleet is there. They've got no control of the sea or anything like that, so they have to do it with paratroopers. And the Luftwaffe just send in their parachute guys, the Fallschirmjäger, under General Kurt Student. And it's an astonishing military feat, because the paratroopers go in and it's carnage. The losses are huge, but they manage to take the airfield, and thereafter the rest of the island, and fairly shortly thereafter, the literally end of May again for the second year running, harken back to Dunkirk, the Royal Navy is finding itself covering running another major evacuation. The British have got to get out of Crete. And it's, this one's bloody. The Luftwaffe is a lot better at anti-shipping. You've got less air cover, particularly now Malmö airfield's gone, and Greece has basically fallen at this point. So, yeah, it starts to get bloody. You get Warspite gets damaged, Valiant gets damaged, famously, of course, with the young Prince Philip aboard. Mountbatten's destroyer Kelly gets sunk along with various others, and it's a mess. And in the middle of this, Cunningham is kind of offered the opportunity to stop the evacuation. And of course, sends the famous signal in response. Takes the Navy 3 years to build a ship. It would take 300 years to rebuild a tradition. The evacuation will continue. A famous, famous line. And of course, the evacuation does continue, but the losses are quite grim. And you know, at the end of it, I mean, Cunningham famously sort of aggressive up and atom guy, and you know, sends at least one cruiser out, you know, telling them to just sort of stiffen their upper lip, and because they're exhausted and at breaking point, they get sunk, and he's then seen on the dockside at Alexandria, you know, virtually tears in his eyes, welcoming them back home. He knows what's going on, but he feels that this has to happen, so they keep pushing ahead, and in amongst all of this, they try to reduce the Luftwaffe air attacks by sending Formidable out to run an airstrike on a German airfield at Scarpanto. And she's escorted by Barham. And basically, this doesn't work terribly well. And you know, all they do really is stir up a hornet's nest of attention. Formidable gets badly damaged, and Barham gets a bomb on Y turret, the one that's manned by the Royal Marines, get badly damaged and has to be sent to Durban in South Africa for repairs for the next few months. Mm.
So it's an interesting part of the war, isn't it, where things are not necessarily going the way the British want them to. It's a particularly bloody part of the war for the Royal Navy.
Absolutely, yes. and it's this is, you know, the losses suffered by the Mediterranean fleet at this point are huge. I mean, they've ironically, literally just before the Crete really kicks off, they receive the reinforcement of the Queen Elizabeth herself arrives on station. So the fleet has been at its most powerful, arguably, but then Crete just smashes its way through a huge amount of that strength in fairly short order. But I mean, the ships do get repaired. Formidable, I think, has to be sent to the US for major repairs. But Barham comes back a few months later and joins with Queen Elizabeth and Valiant. You know, Warspite's damage is far more significant. She gets sent off to the States as well. But she does return before the end of the year, in September, October. The damage gets repaired at Durban, and by the end of September, start of October, she's back with the Mediterranean fleet doing the convoy covers and supporting the army. And also, because of course the Italians are having to support their forces in North Africa with convoys from Italy, and you know, send supplies that way. They're also trying to intercept and stop those. And it's on one of these operations that Barham is tragically lost.
Mm. By a German U-boats patrolling?
Absolutely. I mean, along with the German Air Force and the German troops and the Afrika Corps and so forth, the Germans send U-boats into the Mediterranean to try and affect the war there. And in it's end of November, the British get the message that an Italian convoy is heading for North Africa. And they send a small group of cruisers out to intercept and also use the battle fleet, Queen Elizabeth, Valiant, Bearham, to try and cover this just in case the Italians decide to send out their fleet. So, as we said earlier, the whole idea of the Italians still being stuck in harbour is not really quite accurate. And in essence, the cruisers go in and they sink a couple of ships. But in the midst of all of this, unfortunately, a U-boat, U-331, manages to slip its way through. And it's literally, I think she gets with the U-boat gets within about 300-400 yards of, wow, of one of the British destroyers. And they sort of slip between two of them through the screen. And having, you know, tracked the fleet and got into position, and they get into position, and all of a sudden, you know, Bearham is sat there in the crosshairs of the U-boat skipper through the periscope, and you know, fire a spread of torpedoes, and I think it's four torpedoes go through, and I think it's three of them hit.
Mm.
And Bearham, not terribly well modernized, First World War design, can't take this sort of punishment, and very rapidly starts heeling over, as we see in the film. Crew starts abandoning, and obviously, obviously, Bearham then explodes and sinks very rapidly. U-331 has an interesting time of it, actually, because the combination of firing torpedoes and I think it's Valiant's wake actually makes the submarine broach the surface, and she gets fired at with anti-aircraft guns and so forth before crash diving and going actually noticeably, as I recall, going beyond crush depth, or certainly beyond her safety depth, until she levels out and manages to evade and escape. But it's quite a remarkable one, and obviously a horrible loss for the Royal Navy.
And they kept it quiet, didn't they?
They did. And it's obviously to try to cover the fact that the Mediterranean fleet had been significantly weakened by the loss of
holes, the British power.
Yeah, this hugely powerful battleship. Not long after, of course, Ark Royal has been sunk at the other end of the Mediterranean. And it's, you know, the losses are starting to mount throughout this period for the Royal Navy really, really quite badly. And they do actually notify next of kin. They write out various letters to the 800 or so that are lost. And obviously there are the survivors as well. The next of kin are asked to keep it quiet, and they don't officially announce it. They don't officially announce it until January 1942. So they keep it quiet for a couple of months, really. Unlike the First World War example of HMS Audacious, where they didn't actually bother announcing it until after the end of the war, despite the fact that she'd sunk in the first couple of weeks, which, I mean, everybody knew about, but it was kind of a bit of a ludicrous situation. But they announce it after a couple of months. But there is a curious story attached to the end of this, and it's that in the middle of all of this, the sinking of HMS Bearham results in one of the last convictions for witchcraft in Britain.
I wasn't expecting that.
No, not many people do. It's a fascinating one. Story about, what's her name? Helen Duncan, as I recall, who was a sort of spiritual medium who comes out with, starts telling people that she's seen this sailor dressed in white, and she's been told HMS Baron's been sunk. And I mean, they can't find out who actually leaked it to her, because she just sort of keeps sticking to her story that it's this, right, this spiritual figure. Yeah. And so in the end, they just to kind of shut her up, basically, they convict her of witchcraft and bang her up for 9 months.
Oh, God.
Just to sort of keep her quiet. But I mean, as I say, give or take, there's sort of 800 or so people given letters telling them that HMS Baron's been sunk and, terribly sorry that your son son, father, etc., has been killed. I think they figured on average there's about 10 family members that would thereafter get told. So you can start seeing the thousands upon thousands of people that actually know about this. So it's, as I say, not the best kept secret ever. So there are ways and means in which she almost certainly found out. But it's quite a fascinating one that you get one of the last convictions for witchcraft. I think they abandoned that law in 1944. It's repealed. But she is one of the if not the last convictions for witchcraft in Britain. And this results from the sinking of HMS Baron.
Well, very unexpected ending. And Phil, thank you very much indeed for sharing us the story of this this remarkable ship. And for all of you listening, do please find the Society for Nautical Research on social media and make sure that you watch the footage. Thank you very much. Cheers, Phil.
My pleasure.
Thank you all so much for listening. Do please take the time to find the Society for Nautical Research on social media. We are on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Please also take the time to find the Mariner's Mirror podcast's own YouTube channel, where we have some wonderful and innovative videos teaching you all about our maritime past. But best of all, please, please join the Society for Nautical Research. Your annual subscription will help support this podcast. It will help us publish our quarterly journal, yes, also called The Mariner's Mirror, which has been published for over a century. And it will go towards helping to preserve and protect our maritime past. Members also receive other benefits, not least of which is being able to attend our annual meeting and have dinner on the gun decks of HMS Victory. And we have just launched a series of online winter lectures presented by some of the biggest names in maritime history. Though to attend, you do have to be a paying member. So go on, treat yourself. If you aren't already a member, please join. We hope to see you soon.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.